bad faith on Russia is more that than possible collusion, which I haven't seen demonstrated yet. So I got about a half hour with James Henry on economics, and I think it's a better approach to looking at Manafort as, and it's not a surprise that corporate media wouldn't look at the economic underpinnings and, you know, use this occasion to actually do some background reporting on the kind of non-transparent financial dealings that allowed Manafort to try to get away with what he get away with. I know Trump said he didn't like people that got caught, like he famously said that about McCain in Vietnam, but Manafort looked like an expert money launderer and adept at moving stuff around and to pay for his ostrich jacket or whatever the heck it was. Actually, there's some people that say that was a way of tangible asset transfer, that he would have been able to sell it here. And it's another money transfer. Anyway, speaking of Aretha, I think I have Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentary on Aretha right here. He was a stringer for NPR WHYY in Pennsylvania. He wrote for an African-American weekly, I think. But he also did radio reporting for WHYY, Home of Fresh Air, and Terry Gross. I always meant to look and see what kind of coverage they did of Mumia Abu-Jamal through the years, if they did any at all. It's possibly that they might have been hesitant to do that in the sense of being self-censored. All right, I think I ran down, got Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier. Behind the News is after this show at 11, and it includes an hour program. It's usually two interviews, but they're going to dive deep into some German history, the history of the Bader-Meinhof Brigade and stuff. I'm curious how it'll be treated, but that's just me. Okay, I sort of made a nod to, why don't we hear some commentaries from Amy Goodman and Mumia Abu-Jamal while we got Aretha fresh in mind here.
Aretha, 1942, 2018. With one unmistakable name, a musical legend was born. Aretha. Born on March 25, 1942, in Memphis, Tennessee, raised in Detroit, daughter of the famous gospel preacher Reverend Cecil L. Franklin. She was born to a world made and moved by music. Her father taught her timing and phrasing, but the precocious Aretha learned young that her voice, with its incessant, pure, ascendant tone, could topple walls and open hearts. It took her to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987, and at least five of her many top hits have since become classics. Respect, I Never Loved a Man, Freeway of Love, Share Your Love with Me, and Something He Can Feel. In her matchless career, she had 20 number one hits, from Respect and I Never Loved a Man in 1967, The Freeway of Love, the summer, 1985. Her fans, though, loved her like family. And it didn't really matter where she was on the charts. She sang with utter, moving, emphatic emotion and captured hearts near and far. Her voice, her gift, rang like a bell in the night. But she didn't only shine on stage. During a recent interview, she described herself as a domestic goddess. And what job is harder than raising black children in America? As black mother, she was indeed a goddess, reigning over the rhythms of life and love at home in Detroit. For a black woman to go from the Jim Crow South to become a queen of the kingdom of music and then a goddess at home is no small thing. She was, is, and shall ever be Aretha, who lightened and enriched the hearts of millions around the world. She returns to the celestial choir after 76 summers of earthly life. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Prison Radio, you can Google that. It comes up pretty quick. He's got another judicial proceeding. Still remedy, what was at least an unfair trial. My theory of his case is that he was a thorn in the side of some corrupt police in Philly, which they were rooted out, how do they call it, hook and branch, a number of years later. And Faulkner, the guy that was a cop that was in some way interacting with Mumia's younger brother in the middle of the night in Philly, there's some allegation that he might have been disgusted by the corruption in the police union, and there's some people that argue that it was a way of taking two thorns in the side of this corrupt organization inside the Philly police at the same time. And seems entirely plausible. Don't think that's a conspiracy theory. It's subject to investigation, which it hasn't been yet. Amy Goodman's got one with a great title and a lead quote from I.F. Stone. I haven't mentioned it lately. A good read on Korea is I.F. Stone's A Secret History of the Korean War, which is a compilation of his contemporaneous writings in the 50s, and has a great foreword by Bruce Cummings, who I've been hearing now and again, not as often as he ought to be, on corporate, I guess public media is what I mainly monitor. I don't really go into a lot of corporate video and cable stuff. I track it a little bit through commentaries and critiques, but I don't really have time for all of that. But looking at what the intelligentsia listened to, Mike Morrell again, about the joint letter castigating Trump for his latest use of presidential power, taking away the security clearances of a variety of people. Well, he's only done one so far. He's only postured about a couple of others. But it's a difficult thing to negotiate, because I think Brennan is a war criminal, ought to be tried. I don't think that we should give him an enemy of our enemy. Brennan versus Trump doesn't make him our friend. And same goes for Mueller, too. He had done some horrible things during his part of the GWAT. Just was reading about him meeting with the Ukrainian prime minister and his security aide. This is the prime minister that was negotiating with the EU, but not fast enough or not in the right way. And that led to the Maidan uprising, which I think was hijacked by some very right-wing types. But anyway, that's a lot to roll into one thought. But I've been going back to Ray McGovern and William Binney, and there seems to be a little dissension inside of the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Thomas Drake seems to have distanced himself from some of the allegations. But the latest thing I saw from Binney was that he says, looking at the evidence presented in the Mueller indictment of the that was dropped Friday before the Helsinki meeting, some of the metadata and the documentation from the fellow that has the odd name, Guccifer, shows that it's been manipulated. There's some time stamps and stuff that show that things were, and he uses it to question the entire artifice. He doesn't go quite as far as Ray McGovern does, but McGovern isn't really the expert on the technical end of things. But he suggests that Guccifer is really a construct of Western intelligence, a convenient device in some way. Well, Binney says that, doesn't go that far, but he says that given the fact that there's evidence of manipulation of these files, that they shouldn't be accepted without some corroborating evidence, which we presume maybe the NSA has, but haven't released. Okay, well, it looks like I'm not... need to be moving on here to Amy Goodman's commentary, All Governments Lie.
All Governments Lie. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. All Governments Lie. Those are the words of legendary journalist I.F. Stone. He relentlessly reported on the powerful and the corrupt, and for almost 20 years, until his retirement in 1971, independently wrote I.F. Stone's Weekly, an acerbic, incisive publication that broke news regularly. He revealed how President Lyndon Johnson deceptively exploited the 1964 Tonkin Bay incident to escalate U.S. involvement in Vietnam. Stone produced some of the most impactful investigative reporting on the tobacco industry and its stranglehold on Congress. I.F. Stone's assertion that all governments lie has stood the test of time and seems remarkably apt now during the era of President Donald Trump, perhaps the most prodigious liar among all U.S. presidents. When the news media accurately reports on Trump's bold-faced lies, he attacks, calling the press the enemy of the people. Members of the White House press corps, who are the principal recipients of Trump's constant pejoratives, increasingly express concern for their safety at Trump's many campaign-style rallies, where he revs up the crowd against them.
I'm so proud of myself, I didn't call him the fake news media. I didn't call him. I said to myself, I will not today, in front of our great armed forces, call them fake news. We know the real truth, but we won't say it today.
That was Trump speaking at Fort Drum in upstate New York. Bragging of his restraint, he twice labeled the media fake news. Trump will not relent and certainly will never change. President Trump relies on the news media to repeat and thus amplify his hateful messages. Several news channels have taken the important step of not carrying his rallies live from start to finish. It was that shameful practice that delivered over $1 billion in free airtime to the Trump campaign. But Trump's tweets must be reported. A court ruled them to be official White House statements, and they actually shape policies. The depth of his racism, his misogyny, his Islamophobia, and his viciousness is as newsworthy as it is grotesque. This week, he called Omarosa Manigault Newman, his fired former top African-American woman staffer, that dog. Earlier, he tweeted about an NBA basketball star who's just opened a new school. He tweeted, LeBron James was just interviewed by the dumbest man on television, Don Lemon. He made LeBron look smart, which isn't easy to do, Trump tweeted. Both men are African-American, as is respected Congressmember Maxine Waters, who Trump called, quote, an extraordinarily low IQ person. Trump not only insults African-Americans, but all of us in the process. The best reply to Trump's hostility to the press is more investigative reporting. One problem is that obsessive speculation about the progress of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Trump and Russian election meddling crowds out other vital stories. Take that Fort Drum event, for example. Trump was there to ceremoniously sign the National Defense Authorization Act. He was roundly criticized in the media for failing to mention Senator John McCain, after whom the bill is named. McCain has been one of Trump's most vocal Republican critics and now is suffering advanced brain cancer. Trump's omission was considered offensive and petty, reminiscent of how in 2016 he insulted McCain's military service in Vietnam, saying,
he's not a war hero.
He's a war hero.
He's a war hero.
5.5 years.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
But what about the sheer scale of the bipartisan military spending bill that Trump signed? The $717 billion of public funds committed to weaponry and war is the largest defense authorization in history. As Republicans attempt to shrink or eliminate so-called entitlements like Social Security and Medicaid, reporting on this unprecedented military budget should be at the forefront of every newscast and above the fold of every newspaper. The U.S.-backed Saudi-led war in Yemen is a story that demands daily reporting, but never receives it. Just this week, a school bus was bombed with U.S. bombs, U.S. refueling of the bombers, and U.S. logistics support. 50 people were killed, 40 of them schoolchildren. Over 1 million Yemeni children are on the brink of starvation. Many have starved to death already. Over 18 million Yemenis are hungry, and over 1 million have contracted cholera. It's the largest humanitarian crisis on the planet, yet we hear almost nothing about it. Climate change deserves constant coverage. Sure, our climate change-denying president has called it a Chinese hoax. The news media must aggressively report on this global threat, especially the connection between climate change and extreme weather, like the forest fires consuming so much of California. Donald Trump's attacks on the free press, a vital cornerstone of our democracy, are despicable. More reporting in the tradition of I.F. Stone is the best remedy. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Well said. I heard an interview with William Hartung about the defense budget. I'm going to look for something from Pacifica. I forget what group he's with, but very incisive critic of the ridiculously large so-called defense budget. Remember, it was the Department of War for most of the U.S. Polity's existence. Okay, I don't want to get too derailed. Looks like I'm going to be running a little close here as it stands if I'm going to get on this commentary or this intercepted article of you can find it in print form, I'm sure. It's called Chicago Faces a Defining Moment in Police Relations. It's not a regular podcast from The Intercept. It took me a while to find it, but there is a YouTube audio source. And there's a group called Spoken Edition, which I guess just does that. They get people to voice articles, and I don't know how they choose them. Whether The Intercept's paying a little bit to have this done. Interesting author, and I'm trying to find his name here. Not in this section. Maybe I'll have that before I go into it. But now, I'd spin on the Manafort trial that gets pretty all-partisan, bipartisan critique of financial dealings. Some of it hits pretty close to Illinois. When you have two billionaires competing for the governorship, I guess it's not a surprise that there'll be a critique of both sides. Clearly, I'm personally voting against the Republican control of the gubernatorial, and I would vote for a yellow dog, that yellow dog, as they used to say. But that's just me, and it's not an endorsement. So Dennis Bernstein and James Henry. He has all of James Henry's credentials except the one that I mentioned at the top, which was that James Henry is an advisor, formal advisor to the Tax Justice Network out of the U.K., and I've heard him on their show. They have a monthly show called TaxCast that I find informative, and it's stuff, again, that isn't talked about in the U.S. press of any stripe, because it steps on people's toes who have lots of money, I guess, right? But they seem to get away with it, and James Henry has interesting titled books. So let's check this out. Like I say, this is about the background of the Manafort deal. As I said earlier, Manafort got caught. He shouldn't be a glorified money launderer expert in financial manipulation that Trump might admire, because obviously he's going to get hit for some of the 18. I'm curious, like everyone else is, what the sticking point on the jury is. This was, I believe, recorded on Tuesday, and many people expected a fairly quick verdict, because it looked pretty open and shut. But I think there's at least a couple of the charges of the 18 that are a little more complicated. And we'll find out, I guess. Something about that. The judge says he's been getting death threats, and he's going to not release the name of the jurors. I wonder if there'll be any way of having anonymous interviews with some of the jurors, whether anybody will proceed on that if it gets dicey. So this is from Flashpoints from Tuesday. Views and opinions expressed on the air are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. There's an airshifter training class coming up.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, the trial of Paul Manafort has now, the defense has rested. It is drawing to a close. And what actually is the man on trial for? What is he facing? I believe it's something like money laundering and conspiracy to defraud the U.S. or something like that. And we're going to talk about what he was up to and what the some of the more significant crimes that have been committed that go unpunished by major corporations, by some of the most significant people in the culture. Joining us to talk about this is James Henry. Henry's books include The Blood Bankers, Tales from the Global Underground Economy, The Pirate Bankers. He was featured in the Australian Film Broadcasting Corporation's documentary, Panama Papers. Panama Papers and Mossack Fonseca Explained. Henry is also the former chief economist at the international consultancy firm McKinsey & Company. He's been a fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable International Investment. Well, James Henry, when I was looking at Manafort, looking at the charges, seeing what was going on, I kept thinking about you, because this is you've sort of made a lifetime professional study of understanding money laundering, understanding conspiracy, offshore banking. So I wanted to talk to you about Manafort and put it into some context in terms of what he's been up to, what he has been indicted for, what he's facing charges on, and some of the other things that have been going on that perhaps the U.S. government wasn't as interested in pursuing. First of all, tell us about your understanding of the charges. What did he do wrong?
Well, I think there are several different layers of the charges. One has to do with outright tax evasion just not disclosing or paying taxes on a lot of the $60 million plus that he received from Ukrainian and Russian clients over the last decade or so. With his partner Rick Gates, and basically they were, not disclosing this. Secondly, at the end of this period, they kind of ran out of money. They've been channeling a lot of these payments through offshore companies, but he had enormous personal expenditures. He had a lifestyle that you can't believe, and that was just pretty hard to sustain, even with the $60 million of income, of unreported income. he then took steps to defraud a Chicago bank, apparently, overstating his personal wealth in order to get a substantial loan of $16 million. So that's, bank fraud, and so that's another element of the charges. And then there are always ancillary charges like wire fraud and money laundering that are usually added to these charges. But those are the basic things. He's facing decades in prison.
So he's the kind of guy that said, if we can reduce it to the supermarket, who cannot be happy with sort of filling up the bag two-thirds and sneaking out the side door. He's the guy that's got the stuff tumbling out over the top and out of control.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about all these critters is that they, you know, don't end up having, you know, sort of sustainable lifestyles. I can't believe it's all that satisfying to, you know, be on the front page of the newspapers of the country as being a basic charge with these kinds of crimes. But, you know, that's one of the delights of advanced capitalism. We get to see all this stuff. And I'm particularly interested in the issue about, you know, the fact of the role that offshore banking has played in this story. He had lots of accounts in places like Cyprus, which is a leading European haven, and also in British Virgin Islands. When I started studying this this whole industry back in the 1970s, there was only really about 15 havens that counted. One of them was the Bahamas, you know, Panama. Virgin Islands was on the list, but not as important as several others. Now there's more than 90 offshore havens that provide anonymity, financial secrecy, and facilitating not only tax dodging, but also kleptocracy, organized crime, financial fraud. And, you know, so there's been this explosion of this unregulated underground economy, the global haven industry, and that's what's really facilitating not only Manafort, but, you know, more than $25 to $30 trillion parked offshore by wealthy people around the planet who are not paying taxes on it.
Now, I was speaking with you earlier, planning for this segment, and I was mentioning that I had done some reporting on the Pritzker family. And the Pritzkers go back several generations. And I believe you would know that the prior generation to Penny Pritzker, who was Obama's money bags, got him elected based on being his finance chair and really kicking it big time. Her daddy was sort of one of the visionaries for this offshore operation, wasn't he?
Well, he was, when I first studied this problem back in the 70s, the very first case I got to understand was something called the Castle Bank and Trust, which had been set up by a Chicago attorney and a Miami attorney in Nassau in the Bahamas. And the largest single client for the sort of the chicanery that was going on in this Nassau bank was the Pritzker family. At that stage, it was you know, the father of and brothers, you know, the uncles of the current billionaire generation. But it turned out that the longer back in time you looked at the Pritzker family and the origins of their family fortune, they had a lot of connections with the Central States Pension Fund. You know, with a bunch of shady lawyers in these places, and they weren't really declaring the accounts that they had for the offshore trusts that they were having during this whole period. So there's a long story about you know, the Castle Bank and Trust. It's one of the first offshore banks, and it ended up having not only the Pritzkers as clients, but also people like Mo Dalitz of the Cleveland Mafia. You had the Creedence Clearwater Revival, John Fogerty's group that were had been talked into using the services of the bank to shelter their royalty payments from taxation. So there were about a list of, I have a list of this incredible list of celebrities and, you know, leading Cleveland mafiosa and Chicago, you know, sort of hot, hotel owners who were, you know, who were clients of this bank, weren't reporting any income to the IRS. And they ultimately walked because at the end of the day, after the IRS had investigated this thoroughly, the bank had been formed in 1964. It got closed down around 1972. The IRS had developed a case against these 200 folks who were clients of the bank and the corrupt lawyers who'd set it up. Nixon came in and decided to appoint a new IRS commissioner in 1973. Basically said, oh, there'd been all these violations of liberties and investigating these rich people. he had to close down the investigation without charges in most cases. So at the end of the day, there were very few people who actually were penalized for any of this, and certainly the Pritzkers were not among them. It was a great example of, you know, the role of offshore banking, but it was also an early example of just the extraordinary political influence that the, you know, the ruling elite in this country has across parties. And you know, I think it's a there's a number of good references that people can find about the story, but, you know, it's just, I think, stands out now, especially since we've had Penny Pritzker ended up as Obama's Secretary of Commerce. We have a leading governor candidate in Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, who's a son of Donald Pritzker, who was head of the Hyatt hotel chain and was involved in all this offshore banking. You know, sort of now rising to positions, probably going to be elected governor of Illinois.
Is that at all? I mean, it doesn't seem to be much of a controversy, even though there's a recent story about his offshore operations. But they're saying that because they were all about charity, the Pritzkers are known for their Pritzker Prize and all their charities and stuff like that, that it's not prosecutable.
Well, you know, I'm not a prosecutor.
That's okay. But it doesn't look all that good.
There's broad discretion to do these kinds of prosecutions. Clearly, the original sin in this matter, if you were trying to explain the rise of the family fortune over time, you would say, first of all, this first generation of successful hotel owners had a lot of trafficking with known mafias. People and you know, the Teamster Fund, and you know, they were investing in projects like La Costa and casinos, and they had financing for the Hyatt hotel chain from dubious sources. But the second, sort of original sin was that they closed down in this investigation of the offshore banking activities. And then there's no, over time, the estate tax has become more and more a voluntary tax. So, you know, this early kind of accumulation, primitive accumulation by the first generation, can go on to facilitate the acquisition of enormous amounts of political and social influence on the part of the people who are just inheriting all this accumulated criminal profit and wealth.
You know, I just one. I'm not going to belabor the Pritzkers, other than to say that it is interesting that Penny Pritzker crashes on SNL, which ends up costing the U.S. government essentially $1 billion. Some 1,400 to 1,700 depositors lose some of all of their money, and the federal regulators sort of make Penny Pritzker a deal that she definitely can't refuse. She walks away from that whole mess to become the key player in electing Barack Obama. And she becomes Commerce Secretary. But nobody knows that the Pritzkers, I mean, you have to say they could have been as guilty as Manafort. I mean, Manafort did some of those other ugly, overt things, but how can we evaluate the level of money that the Pritzkers managed to not pay in terms of what it owes to the United States government and the people? How much did they steal? Never mind.
Well, I just know that if you went go back in time, that you find that they were certainly up to no good during this period. But let's not single out the Pritzkers.
Okay.
I think that this is kind of a chronic problem that we have with both political parties in the United States. We have, over time, political power has come to be a reflection of economic influence on a whole set of issues. And, you know, we now have just had Trump and his friends at Goldman enact probably one of the largest wealth transfers to corporate America in U.S. history. I calculate, you know, the fact that they had $2.6 trillion offshore, they were supposed to apply a 15% roughly tax to it for people who were supposedly bringing it back. But they gave all of these corporations like Apple 8 years to pay this 15% tax, distributed over those years with only 5% of the tax due the first year, 5% the second, and so on. So that, you know, at the same time, going forward, we now have a territorial income tax. So if they, you know, and there's, thirdly, there's no requirement that they actually invest the money in jobs here. They don't even have to bring it back. They're free to keep it offshore and just pay the tax. And so you can calculate it out that, you know, at the end of the day, they're actually paying about 1% effective taxation on all this money they accumulated offshore. It's just this gigantic $800 billion giveaway. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff is not, doesn't require haven engineering. It's hiding in plain view in the tax bills that basically the Republican Party signed up for in this case. But most Democrats in the Senate and the Congress didn't even read the bill. I was the first one to notice this one paragraph in the bill that said they had, you know, 8 years to pay this back, which is just outrageous. So, I mean, I think the issue is that on a host of economic issues, we have neither party really taking seriously the notion of having fair taxation, progressive taxation. And over time, we've seen, you know, a larger and larger share of the costs of living being transferred to the middle class and the poor. We're going to have huge deficits as a result of this corporate tax bill. I didn't hear the Pritzker family coming out against this this corporate tax giveaway. I suspect that most of corporate America kind of quietly said, oh, great, you know, licking our chops. You know, the so-called progressive companies like Apple, you know, didn't say boo about it. They just pocketed the money. And, you know, more than $100 billion of tax savings to Apple alone. I mean, it's really no accident that the stock market, you know, is rising during this period. I mean, if we transferred the entire national park system to corporate America, their stocks would rise too. But the rest of us are not better off unless we have productive investments and real jobs in which we use the offshore money, if we would have used it, to finance the essential spending that government has to do on roads and highways and hospitals and education. And that is the opportunity cost of this kind of biased system that we have.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with James Henry. Henry's books include The Blood Bankers, Tales from the Global Underground Economy, and The Pirate Bankers as well. He was featured in a recent Australian Broadcasting Corporation documentary, Panama Papers and Mossack Fonseca Explained. We need that explained a lot more. And he has experience in the mainstream. He was a former chief economist at the international consultancy firm McKinsey & Company and has been a senior fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable International Investment. So, you know, in terms of what could we learn? I mean, here we have a caricature, a man in Manafort of sort of the abuse of the system. Not that it's the biggest abuse, but sort of doing everything illegal at once.
I would say since the global financial crisis of 2008, there emerged a kind of increasing attention worldwide on the unsavory role of offshore havens like Cyprus and BVI and Panama and Bahamas. Less attention to the role of onshore havens like Delaware, but for a while we had the G20 and the OECD, you know, major international bodies like the World Bank getting behind reforming the system and cleaning it up so that major companies aren't able to park profits offshore. And individuals, wealthy individuals, or crooks, or kleptocrats, or people like Manafort with ill-gotten gains aren't able to use this offshore secrecy system either. But, you know, that whole effort to clean this up made a lot of progress until 2017, and then it's basically stalled. And the United States has now become, by any measure, the world's leading tax havens. I mean, this is the place where you can really still find ironclad anonymity. There's no beneficial ownership registration for companies and trusts. There is no participation in the kind of reciprocal automatic information exchange that the EU and the OECD was looking for with respect to tax compliance. On a host of levels, we have kleptocrats, you know, the Ukrainians that Manafort was working for, you know, were pouring their money into Miami and New York, into anonymous companies that were owning real estate here, creating real estate bubbles in these places. We have the same thing going on with Chinese kleptocrats coming to pour their money into real estate in the United States. I mean, I would suggest that that's an unhealthy basis for the United States to become the world's leading tax haven, because the kind of people who are attracted with those vehicles are not really the folks who share democratic values and are willing to abide by the rule of law. And so this strategy of becoming a tax haven rather than collaborating with other countries to help have fair international taxation, to clean up the offshore havens and to have more financial reporting on our states like Delaware and Nevada, and rather than get into the business of competing to attract this money, we ought to be cleaning it up.
How is there a way that you can evaluate the amount of money that we lose in terms of taxes in this country through this facile use of these offshore havens and onshore havens for that?
Well, the estimates have been done for the multinational companies that are parking money offshore, putting their intellectual property offshore, their software and patents and so forth, and then paying themselves royalties tax-free. That alone was on the order of $200 billion a year of lost tax revenue. That would clearly be enough to put a pretty good down payment on things like, Medicare for all, or college aid. People were complaining that, Bernie Sanders didn't have a way to pay for it. Well, what he didn't make enough of was the fact that we have tax solutions, fair taxation of corporations and wealthy individuals that could really fill the bill here. So, on the individual side, the estimates vary, but I think, with most people agree that it's at least $100 billion a year of lost income there. This is vital tax revenue. Without it, we're going to be slashing social spending. We're going to be slashing Medicare. There's a real connection between tax justice and justice with respect to climate change, with respect to, social programs as well, because, they always are on the block whenever the deficits start to rise. And there's no instance in history where these tax cuts have actually paid for themselves. That's kind of a standard conservative argument, but there's just no evidence for it. So we end up slashing social spending and ending up with more inequality, more poverty, more harmful climate change as a result of not having fair taxation.
Well, you had a lot to do with sort of studying and reacting to the Panama Papers, and I believe later the Paradise Papers. What did we learn from all of this?
I think we had a good example of the structure of this international industry. The Panama Papers, we had one Panama law firm alone, which with only about 500 employees that were in 30 different countries, but they were just one of maybe a couple hundred Panamanian law firms that are doing this kind of business, and worldwide they're just a small part of the global haven industry. But you found that they were serving more than 200,000 offshore companies. They were serving 500 banks that were using them for kind of off the shore secrecy, I think we got a pretty good idea that this was a global industry that's pretty seamless. The second thing we understood was that there's a lot more to this than just tax dodging. A lot of the people who are making use of these companies are basically stealing money from their own governments. We had a dictator in Angola, for example, parking money in by way of Mossack companies in offshore, not paying any income from it, just stealing the money from the treasury. But that was going on in Pakistan, in India, in South Africa, and in first world countries as well, just as a result of this kind of unregulated black hole in the global economy. So the idea that you have jurisdictions like Panama or Delaware being able to get away with selling anonymity and secrecy to people who, can't explain the origins of their income, that's just outrageous, and it's really affecting, the ability of governments to function and to compete with each other effectively, because they have they're basically having a hard time raising the capital that they need to make vital public expenditures.
There's been a large and growing sucking sound. It started with Ronald Reagan and the deregulation of Glass-Steagall, killing Glass-Steagall and deregulating the SNLs. They were gutted by the looters, the taxpayers. The money went upwards. Then came 2008. The big banks went down. Everybody knew as soon as they watched the SNLs as a model, they knew the same thing was going to happen with the big bound. Another big banks, another big sucking sound of money upwards. And now you're saying, how would you as we face this beautiful tax cut for the rich, we're going to hear even a larger sucking sound. There's not going to be much left of the middle class and the working class, is there?
Well, the problem is that we don't have leadership, I think, in terms of either party being able to articulate an alternative path. You know, the problem is that taxes are kind of boring to a lot of people. They don't want to take the time to understand all this stuff, which is actually at the core of the global economic system these days. You know, it's remarkably straightforward, though. Once you spend a little bit of time on it, you look at how the current tax cuts have ignited basically a race to the bottom among different countries. So the United States cuts its corporate taxes, Australia cuts theirs, the UK responds. Pretty soon, everybody is dealing with, you know, virtually a gutting of the global corporate income tax. You know, conservatives like to believe that that's good. We're all better off with no taxation. But when you look at the actual need for public expenditures in many different sectors of the economy, you find over and over again that public investment has been starved. For expenditure, we're underinvesting in real R&D. We're underinvesting in infrastructure. You know, in the future of alternative energies, and you know, in education. These are areas where the rates of return are much higher than you can get by investing in bank CDs, which is where a lot of this money ends up. So I think we really have to look at how you know, both parties have to look at making tax justice a much more central focus for their proposals going forward. We're not interested in confiscatory taxation, but, you know, the United States, 20 years ago, we had corporate and individual tax rates north of 50%, and the economy was doing, you know, was growing faster. It isn't just, you know, high taxes that are the enemy. There's also the question of social justice. And, you know, basically we've tried this experience with lower and lower tax rates over time, with more and more tax competition across countries, and time and again we found, you know, this is just the wrong path. We have to define a better one.
All right. Well, we thank you for helping us understand a little better what's been going on there in the world of finances. We've been speaking with James Henry. Again, his books include The Blood Bankers, Tales from the Global Underground, and terrific work in terms of working towards financial justice and trying to be our translator from very sort of somewhat difficult economic structures translations so that we can all understand. We appreciate that very much.
Well, if we learn nothing more from the Manafort case, we ought to see a glaring example of how this offshore haven industry is just facilitating lots of dodgy behavior. And, you know, we ought to end it.
And Paul Manafort is not the top of the offenders. He may be the most prominent one to be prosecuted, but he ain't the richest. Anyway,
yeah, that's right.
Anyway, thanks for being with us, James Henry.
You're quite welcome.
Pirate Bankers, Blood Bankers. Those are some of the book titles. James Henry, he's an advisor to UK-based Tax Justice Network, too, and I guess he's got some sinecure at NYU, as well as doing a lot of volunteering. He came out of the business, so he knows. He mentioned resources about Castle Bank, and I was looking around just a little bit, and just as he was being a little optimistic that if nothing else we learn, the media isn't helping us learn about all of these financial shenanigans, I'll call them. The Castle Bank and Trust in Bahama, actually the Tax Justice Network has a specialty report on the Bahamas as a tax haven. They've always been, and actually being eclipsed now, as was mentioned. But I wanted to mention Penny Lernow, the late great investigative journalist. Her book was In Banks We Trust. I see there's a nice... is this a review or is this... there's some citations at Third World Traveler. Penny Lernow, spelled sort of the French style, L-E-R-N-O-U-X. In Banks We Trust has a pretty long section about the Castle Bank and implicating the Pritzker family, which I think she made the claim that they were sort of grandfathered in when this kind of tax haven stuff was being legislated about. Not that it's stopping a lot, since there are still workarounds, but for some reason the Pritzker Foundation was allowed to continue to do it legally, and they still managed to bottle up the South Shore Bank, bottle it up, bring it down, run it into the ground. There sort of were they did the kind of real estate transactions at the residential level that became the root of this is an assertion of the what broke down the financial structure. Though there were a lot of other devices like these credit default swaps. All the coverage of the instability in Turkey and very little mentioning of credit default swaps. These are bets placed about what the interest rate in one particular locality or another. And they sort of make it to hedge, banks make it to hedge their exposure, as it were, to. But all of the coverage of the Turkish lira problem, none of it really brought that up. So that's another thing I wanted to try and get to. Too bad Doug Harnwood isn't doing it today. Maybe I should pop him a line. Ask him to cover that. All right, I mentioned at the top that I was going to do this intercepted excerpt. It's a spoken edition. They're doing some readings of their articles. It's not really the best thing for radio, but I've got about a 10-minute segment excerpted from this article. Chicago faces a defining moment in police reform and civil order. And I still don't have the author's name. I believe it's Andy Clavins. He's working with the Invisible Institute, which is a journalism outfit that I think they're the people that actually got the Laquan Davis video out, if my memory serves. I don't think that's actually mentioned in this piece. But this doesn't tell me the author either. So he's going to read a bit of this article to you, starting with a segment on Laquan James, where he compares this to the Emmett Till, the brutality of both, or an analogy I think he makes in this segment. Andrew Clawins, I believe, is his name. And the Intercept is still on hiatus. I haven't heard any Jeremy Scahill. I guess he's on holiday. Maybe he's on assignment somewhere. Hope he's doing okay. And we'll just hear about an 8-minute segment before Behind the News with Doug Henwood. And Gina, I think I'll be in to do continuity today. Thank her for that. And thanks for listening. Taste of Champagne's got a lot of musical offerings and food offerings, obviously. That's sort of what it's about. Great stuff. The Friday Night Live, I haven't been making it to, but I had to go out and see the Lady Legends, and it was an awesome show. I did a Aretha Franklin tune. They had already planned and rehearsed it before she passed this week. So, chain. Okay, here's from The Intercepted about Chicago. I played some Flint Taylor. He's got a book coming out about breaking the story on the torture regime under D.A. Daley.
Of that story is, in some respects, a mystery. Why this particular incident, this particular victim? A partial explanation is that the horror of the incident was compounded by the institutional response to it, by the knowledge that the city knew what happened and withheld that information from the public for over a year, while maintaining a patently false official account of the shooting that ultimately collapsed, exposing the machinery of the code of silence. Whatever the reasons, the public narrative of McDonald now bears comparison to that of another child of Chicago, Emmett Till. The footage of McDonald curled in a fetal position on the ground as Van Dyke fires again and again and again, 16 times, is akin to Till's open casket, a portal through which the mutilated body of a child becomes the focal point for perceptions of underlying systemic pathologies. The cascade of events that followed the McDonald revelations, the firing of the police superintendent and the head of the Independent Police Review Authority, the mayor's appointment of a task force on police accountability, the electoral defeat of the state's attorney, and the intervention by the U.S. Department of Justice was animated by the widely shared recognition that what had been exposed was intolerable and that fundamental reform was imperative. On December 9, 2015, at the height of the political firestorm following the video's release, Emanuel gave a speech to a special session of the Chicago City Council. It was arguably his finest moment as mayor. Visibly traumatized, he spoke with emotion and moral urgency. Chicago, he said, faces, quote, a defining moment on the issues of crime and policing and even the larger issues of truth, justice, and race. He acknowledged that a code of silence exists within the Chicago Police Department, and he committed his administration to a sustained process of reform, asking, in effect, that Chicagoans and history judge him by that single measure. Addressing a shaken city, the mayor evoked a crisis of the civil order that demands we break with business as usual. What's required, he declared, is that we embark on a process of becoming a different kind of society. One, as he put it, in which a black child would be treated no differently by the police than his own children. Chicago's path to a consent decree. The mayor has not consistently projected the sort of leadership he showed that day. Frequent wobbles and pivots have left him looking reactive and defensive. More often than not, he's appeared intensely tactical in the absence of a strategy. As a result, he has not told the story of reform in such a way that the public can clearly see particular measures as elements of a coherent larger plan. At each successive stage in the reform process, the mayor's first impulse, his political instinct, has been to balk. Then, as political pressure builds, he ultimately moves forward. This is not inspiring leadership, but it is a reasonably predictable political dynamic that advances the process, so long as sustained public pressure is applied. Substantial progress has been made over the last 3 years. Among other things, a new agency, the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, has been established to investigate police shootings and allegations of excessive force, and the Inspector General of Chicago has been empowered to monitor the police department. Yet, the reform process has often seemed becalmed and adrift, making it hard to assess progress. There are no firm coordinates. The sensation is akin to swimming across a large body of water and not being able to see either shore. That will almost surely change now that the draft consent decree has been released. The complex 233-page document includes provisions dealing with use of force, crisis intervention, supervision, accountability, transparency, hiring and promotion, and officer wellness. According to the parties, the one outstanding issue they have not yet been able to resolve is whether officers will be required to file a report when they point a gun at someone. In order to grasp both the promise of the consent decree process and the challenges it faces, it's important to understand its history. After Donald Trump was elected, the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice pushed to finalize the report on its investigation of the Chicago Police Department, releasing it a week before the inauguration. Once the new administration assumed office, it quickly became apparent that Attorney General Jeff Sessions had no intention of negotiating a consent decree on the basis of the report. He condemned such decrees as politically expedient measures that, quote, will cost more lives by handcuffing the police instead of the criminals, and declared that Department of Justice would no longer enter into them. Soon after the inauguration, Emanuel reached out to Sessions and sought to negotiate a non-binding memorandum of agreement to govern police reform in Chicago. When word of the MOA negotiations leaked, it was widely derided as toothless, and the process ran aground. In light of the new realities, civil rights lawyers at the University of Chicago and Northwestern University law schools developed a community-driven legal strategy for rebooting the consent decree process. In June 2017, they filed a class action suit, Campbell v. City of Chicago, on behalf of a group of individual and organizational plaintiffs extending across the spectrum, from Black Lives Matter organizations to the NAACP and Urban League. They argued that their clients were at high risk of having their constitutional rights violated by the police and sought widespread injunctive relief and police oversight under the supervision of a federal judge. Colleagues at the Invisible Institute provided statistical analysis for the Campbell lawsuit. The Campbell suit received immediate public support. It was endorsed by editorials in both Chicago newspapers and the New York Times, and by various institutional players such as Chicago's Inspector General. The American Civil Liberties Union subsequently filed a parallel suit seeking a consent decree on behalf of people with disabilities. The Emanuel administration, however, declined the invitation to negotiate and sought to have the suit dismissed. It argued that the plaintiffs lacked standing and that a consent decree was unnecessary because the city was in the process of implementing the desired reforms. That was the context in which, 2 months after the filing of the Campbell suit, Lisa Madigan, the state attorney general, sued the city seeking a consent decree on the basis of the patterns of unconstitutional policing documented in the DOJ report. And that was the context in which Emanuel took a step he had initially resisted and agreed to negotiate. At that point, the process ceased to be public and became a matter of lawyers brokering an agreement behind closed doors. The Campbell and ACLU attorneys were not at the table and so did not participate in crafting the decree. They did, however, succeed in securing a memorandum of agreement with the city and the attorney general under which their clients have a significant role in enforcing the terms of the decree. The consent decree is a dense document. In assessing its provisions, it's important not to allow the